guess we'll go. I mean, I really like digging into the numbers on climate change and you know, questions like population and limiting resources and things like that. But those are symptoms, and they're not the disease per se. And so to be able to really fully grasp the big picture here, I need big picture synthesis ideas, a big picture perspective on how all of it fits together. And so that's kind of how I evolved from, you know, teaching a course on Silent Spring or Sand County Almanac or some of that classic environmental literature, and you sort of follow the trail and you end up in the social justice arena. That's where you end up. So I don't want to say too much more about this because I'm going to read the fable to you, and I just want you to interpret it in the raw, however you want to interpret it. I mean, that's kind of because it can be viewed in many different ways, and so it's been fascinating to me. I've taught two different courses based around this fable, so it's not the only thing we do in the class, but it's the starting point, and. It's fascinating to have people read this, have the students read this and come up with their own perspectives. And there's been some pretty interesting ideas about what they think the fable means. But before we get to that at all, I want to have a conversation about just this concept of happiness in the first place. And so, you know, we obviously in this country value something about happiness very, very much. This is from the Declaration of Independence. And I'm sure that you've all seen this before, but what stands out to you here?
Well, the
all
truth.
Men.
Yeah,
the truth is self-evident.
It doesn't say all American men. It doesn't say all white men. It doesn't say all European origin men. Men, I'm just gonna, you know, allow for the time, but all.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing from a social justice perspective there. There's no distinguishing there between people of color and white Europeans. But at the same time, there's no acknowledgement of women. At the time, of course, they probably were wrapping that all in, but it's not there. So that's kind of a fascinating thing to think about. What else?
I've always, I guess, appreciated that the right is to the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a right to happiness, you have a right to try to be happy.
So the focus is on the pursuit. What else do you see, anything in particular that jumps out at you?
Well, the creator, and then the underlying tenet of all of this stuff is there is a creator of some sort.
That there are other unalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but those aren't the only.
Yeah, but I suppose from a legal perspective, since they didn't list it, they don't count. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting. I mean, what do you think happiness even means?
It's different for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess in my reading about this in the past, they said, well, happiness more specifically referred to acquiring property and sort of material satisfaction, if you will.
Some countries have a happiness index.
Yeah.
Which probably is not related to materialism.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's a state of mind.
And then that also brings into sort of, you know, another interesting conversation here is happiness versus joy. How would you define those two things? Are they the same? Are they synonyms?
I haven't done any reading on this, but just from the historical context of Thomas Jefferson writing this, what did the pursuit of happiness mean in 1789? 76 when this was written? I mean, was it religious freedom? Was it owning property? And that's what I assume their idea of happiness meant, was religious freedom and being able to live life the way you wanted to live life. Independence.
Of course, your pursuit of happiness presumably can't mess with other people's life or liberty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's an important perspective here too, that, you know, there are limits.
Yeah, that pursuit of happiness sometimes reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof, you know, where there's a young man who's vying for this woman's love, and he just feels like he's not enough, he's not going to be able to care for her or whatever, and somebody says, you know, even a poor man is entitled to some happiness.
Yeah, that's a good line.
And it reminds me of that, and so in that case, happiness is to be able to...
That was the tailor, right?
Right, yeah. So, you know, in that case, to build a home and a family and, you know, what he wanted. But I see it's different for different people.
So what about this happiness versus joy thing? Some more thoughts on that?
Did you attend the C.S. Lewis? Did anybody attend the Wednesday? Because there's a 6 points about joy that Lewis said, and it really is not nostalgia. It's an ache in the heart, a bittersweetness, a hope for an ideal, a sense of incompleteness or imperfection. It's very different from what we think of as happiness, which is just, yay, everything's great. A bittersweet emotion of longing. This is a nice one, a living in the present in which the past and future are closely tied. Symbolic richness. A reflection on life that makes sense of the rest of existence.
Yeah, I mean, so happiness, I think, is fleeting. You have moments of happiness, and then they're gone. Joy tends to be more your state of being, your state of mind, and how you kind of view yourself within the whole world. And it doesn't mean that it's a constant state of happiness, but it just means that you're kind of at peace. You've got some level of peace with your situation and the situation around you. And so, I mean, I kind of put that in here, changing definitions with the time, because I think I'm wondering now if Thomas Jefferson wrote this again, if he would put the pursuit of joy based on current definitions instead of the pursuit of happiness. I don't know that, but it's just something that I've been speculating on. Yeah.
Well, then, as we were talking about sort of contentment, then it, I mean, not just changing definitions of the time, but with the place, I'm guessing they weren't thinking of Buddhism. You know, pursuit of happiness is, you know, you achieve happiness through sort of, you know, and the acceptance of happiness or realization of happiness rather than the pursuit or, you know, that the striving sort of, you know, Buddhist would say negates the idea of happiness.
And I mean, so the interesting, well, another interesting thing about happiness is that there's really no neurological basis for it. You can map many other things onto the brain and where the brain, how the brain does it, but there is no center of happiness in your brain. It's just sort of, so from an evolutionary standpoint, happiness is not a very useful thing, because to be content, to be happy means you get lazy and you get eaten. And so, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, you need to be always on your toes and you need to be ready to go for the next thing here too. So it's kind of an interesting concept as well. So the point of this particular article that I was reading about it is that, you know, there's no natural basis for happiness, so why keep stressing about it so much? And there's like an $11 billion industry in this country here to try to push you toward happiness. If you're not happy, there's something wrong and you need to pay us money to become happy. And so that's kind of the gist of this idea, that it's an artificial construct in a lot of ways. so this article also talked about this, really powerful individual back in the, I think, Middle Ages, who had all sorts of success in culture and war and money and two harems, everything he wanted. He decided to go back over his life and count how many days he had been happy, and he came up with 14. So this is somebody who is as positioned as anybody could possibly be to have maximum amount of happiness, and he could still only come up with 14 days of being happy. And so I think that really puts the perspective back on pursuit. And it's sort of the striving toward that that's sort of more important than the actual happiness. I mean, you heard that in terms of goals, too. A lot of times you've got a goal that you strive for, you get your goal. Now what? It's the striving that makes you alive. The achieving, and then, you know, what happens as soon as you achieve it, it's like, well, what's the next goal? I mean, that was too easy. What's next? Yeah.
I have a story that I have to share along those lines. It's not exactly related to happiness, but maybe it ties into what you're saying. So, Alex Honnold, the climber, free soloed El Capitan last year. Mm-hmm. So he went up with no ropes. A very challenging climb. It usually takes people with ropes days. He did it in 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And he got to the top, and there was a crew from National Geographic there asking, how do you feel, and so on. So great. What are you going to do this afternoon? He said, I'm going to go work out. I'm going to go do the hangboard. And they're like, what? And he's like, I am what I want to be right now because I do hangboard exercises today. Mm-hmm. It's hangboard day. Mm-hmm. Why would I change that? Mm-hmm. I love where I am. Uh-huh. Why would I stop?
So, I mean, it sounds like he's sort of living more in a state of joy.
Absolutely.
And he's just, as long as he's doing whatever he's doing, the goals don't even matter. That sort of hitting that threshold doesn't matter.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that fits really well, too. Yep.
To kind of challenge that interpretation of the brain, people like a guy named Shelley Taylor, a neuroscientist from California, would say it's human attachments, which release oxytocin, which create a sense of well-being, trust, and so it may also be interesting that oxytocin is elicited by all three of the Greek love definitions, mm-hmm. erotic, friendship, philia, serving others, and maybe that serving others has the highest release of oxytocin. Mm-hmm. Because we may have survived not through the fittest, but because we were most generous and helped one another. So that suddenly would break out of our Western way of thinking, and somehow your purpose comes by being living in harmony with other human beings. And that would be happiness and well-being in many cultures of the world, but probably not.
Yeah, but the tricky part about this country is that it's very, very individualistic, and so the pursuit of happiness is often, the individual pursuit of happiness, and it's I don't know, I guess narcissistic. You could think of it as being a little bit narcissistic in this country, just that trying to get after the happiness. Any other thoughts or comments on this before we move along?
Okay. So- Some of this is the realm of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're striving, working three jobs, I mean, you may be looking for pursuit of happiness, but it might not be your luxury to worry about how joyful you are in the moment. I don't know.
Like those, there are more, like food and water.
I guess it comes into life, maybe.
Maybe so, yeah.
I think a lot of us, probably including myself, don't really know what would make me happy. And I think...
Holden it makes you happy.
Yeah, sure, sure. But despite my privilege, I don't think I'm constantly happy, and I don't think I'd be significantly less... I'm a basically happy person, and I don't think I'd be significantly less happy if I fell in hard times. I mean, it would be harder, but it's not like I'm...
I was saying that the pursuit of it, the looking for gratification and goods and material things and experiences is kind of a realm of privilege. It may, not to the exclusion of people who don't pursue it.
Right.
But when you, I'm thinking lifestyles of the rich and famous kind of, you know, which includes.
Yeah, but are they really happy?
So no, we have a friend who goes to Guatemala a few times a year, and he's got contacts and he wants to help with water purity and dental and hearing aid stuff with the folks that live in the villages that he lives in. Very altruistic. But another friend's son, college-age son, went down there to spend 3 weeks with him in Guatemala. And this other son is the son of a physician, so a lot of privilege, a lot of wealth. And he's there working side by side with the first friend I described. And we talked to Mark when he got back visiting
the kid.
Yeah. We talked to the kid when he got back, and the number one thing out of his mouth that he was so surprised about is how happy everybody was.
Absolutely.
And they're this is an impoverished area of Guatemala, but it was palpable to him how happy everybody there was, even though there wasn't stuff and wealth.
Same experience. I went on a mission trip to Honduras. Same experience there.
And
that's, people are happier than I am.
Yeah. And a lot of that is, I mean, a lot of that happened after World War II, and just there's this cultural revolution here in the U.S. where everything turned toward materialism, and so that was a very, very much marketing campaign that got us to the place right now where we cannot be content unless we have the latest of everything. And so the good news is that there is the potential that we could roll it back, because we, you know, it didn't used to be the way that it is right now. You know, 60 years ago, it wasn't like this, so it could go back, but it'd be challenging.
Since 2000, there's been a paradigm shift in the field of psychology toward positive psychology instead of studying what's wrong with people, was our specialty before that. And so there's quite a lot of research on things like this. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to APA and you go to forgiveness research or other things. And I think there are people that write about happiness that say that you don't get it by pursuing it. Mm-hmm. It's really not a goal that you're going to get by chasing it. It's an outcome of a life of purpose well lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I ask people what the meaning of life is, and my answer to that is to live a meaningful life, which is similar to what you were saying, what you just said right now, a life of purpose, and then you get that joy or that happiness. All right, before we get going too long, let's get to the happiness machine here. So I'm going to read this to you, and I want you to kind of listen and think what you want to think, interpret it how you want to interpret it. I do have copies of this, and so I'll hand it around here after the fact, but I just kind of want to read it to you first. So this is the happiness machine, a fable. Once upon a time, there was a kingdom of people who pursued happiness. This is the first time I've actually looked at that line there and realized that this is probably a direct shot at the Declaration of Independence. Nothing was more important to them than being happy. The happier they became, the happier they wanted to be. The source of the people's happiness was a magic happiness machine. Whenever the people felt unhappy, they would pour their troubled feelings into the happiness machine. The magic machine would melt their feelings down and purify them. The residue of their troubles became dross, and the dross was drained away and dumped into a distant part of the kingdom. The people would take their purified feelings and go away singing and feeling happy again. They were called the happy people. As the years and centuries went by, the happy people became happier and happier because of the wonderful effects of the happiness machine. There was only one problem. Another group of people lived in a distant part of the kingdom where all the dross was dumped. The dross made them very unhappy. They were called the unhappy people. The more dross that was dumped on them, the unhappier they became. However, the unhappy people were not permitted to use the happiness machine because the one thing the magic machine could not do was purify its own dross. The unhappy people complained to the happy people about the problems that they had with the dross. But the happy people ignored their complaints. When they were confronted with the troubling results of their happiness, the happy people simply took their troubled feelings to the happiness machine, and it made them happy again. It was easy to believe that it was not the dross of their own troubles that had made other people unhappy. Rather, they convinced themselves that the unhappy people were just incurably unhappy and that they had nobody but themselves to blame for their unhappiness. It was not long before the unhappy people began to protest more insistently about their situation. They organized marches and demonstrations. They demanded that the dross be removed from their part of the kingdom, and they demanded a fair share of happiness for their people. But the happy people turned a deaf ear to their protests, which only served to make the unhappy people unhappier, and they protested all the more. Finally, the happy people could no longer ignore the protests. They used force to put down the protesters and arrested and jailed the leaders. They passed laws and organized military force to control the unhappy people. Many of the unhappy people were killed. This only made them unhappier. They began to plot and plan how they could destroy the happiness machine. The conflict and tension caused a severe drain on the happy people's happiness. To make it worse, some of the happy people were becoming increasingly troubled about the way the unhappy people were being treated. All these new troubles made the happiness machine work even harder, and as a result, even more dross was produced. They had to build an even bigger and better happiness machine to take care of the happiness needs of the happy people. Consequently, the dross was piled higher and higher and spread farther and farther into other parts of the kingdom, which made more and more unhappy people. It was not long before the unhappy people were in a constant state of rebellion. Then a new and even greater danger arose. The happiness machine had become so large and productive that there was no place left in the kingdom to put the dross. The piles of dross crept closer and closer to the homes of the happy people and to the place where the happiness machine was operating. There was an ominous threat that the dross would back up into its own machine and the machine would self-destruct. Now the happy people were troubled not only by the rebellion of the unhappy people, but also by their own happiness machine. The new danger caused even greater internal troubles among the happy people. Some people began to sorrowfully predict that the happiness machine would soon self-destruct. Others suggested that the only alternative was to build an even bigger happiness machine in order to deal with the crisis they were facing. Others began to see that the happiness machine was not the solution to their problems, but the cause. They wanted to reduce the size of the happiness machine or even dismantle it altogether. Some even began to wish that they could join together with the unhappy people and build a new society together without the help of happiness machines. And then the story goes on that, it concludes with that the end of this story has not yet been written. And it's up to us to figure out how the story will end. And this is, this is by Joseph Barnes. I'll tell you where it's from.
It is from Joe Barnes?
Joseph Barnes, yeah.
Oh, I know Joe.
Do you?
That is really interesting.
Yeah. So what I would like for you to do, let's see, what do we have for? I'd just like to get you into maybe three groups of here and just talk about what you heard and how you interpret it. And I can pass out some copies here if you need to refer back to it. Again, I don't want you to pollute you with the dross of my own interpretation.
I thought it was Dan Erlander that had written this.
Oh, really?
Or Dr. Seuss.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of our current problems can be plugged into this.
And kind of having the disparities in our world now. Some people's wealth or happiness comes at others' expense.
But it's an interesting assumption based on our initial discussion. Well, can't
So for example, if I'm living in an urban area,
and yet
there are people that don't
just have like homes before the red is just map. We're saying
we should all pay more for
our
house.
Obviously that's not happening.
And then the people who are like
over the chart.
Migrants coming up from Mexico, you know, just the boundaries that we set, northeastern Michigan, south Chicago, just keep it all there and don't let people us take care of ourselves. We have our rights to our things, our way of
living. It's got to be a shift
on the other side.
And And the white clergy
is
and he writes this most incredible
stress and creates
response.
It really is a good sort of summary situation, including some people's toast called
that. And so I see
some of the happy
clergy
and aware of that
one of these groups
solution to our problems
suggested. That they
It's got its tentacles and everything. Everything. Corporate capitalistic.
That's a huge bit of all around the room. It's fascinating. Class discussions are somewhere around 7 minutes.
It's just everything.
There must be some psychological solution for that as well.
Someone says just the children.
Which is making it.
Because, you know, you have this cyclical poverty. I work in a school. We have about
300
so many levels.
And you see the parents, the grandparents coming through, which is all poverty, so complicated with attrition and knowing about valuing education.
It's kind of old. It's cold. It's calculating. It's a fraud, isn't it?
Yeah. That would be a good way. That's a better way to
say it. Multi-layered.
But it's leaving some people.
We need a good leader.
There's another concept, and that is when you are not meeting the needs of the way humans have evolved.
Ask questions when I
live in balance.
I say, how do you feel about this? And I listen. And then I get a little
shorter.
Two, these sentences.
The great last paper name was
It sounds like we might be at a point here where we could sort of bring this back around to everybody and just kind of get some ideas now about what people have been thinking. So what are some of the ideas, some of the interpretations that have come out in your groups for what this represents?
We all went straight to climate change.
Climate change. Okay. And so under climate change, I mean the happiness machine is burning fossil fuel. And the dross is the CO2.
Consumption.
What's that?
Consumption in general.
Yeah. Consumption. The dross is CO2 into the atmosphere, and then of course, you know, you've got all the poor folks whose islands are flooding, and all sorts of climate refugees, I guess. So we'll call it that, just for simplicity. And of course, they are not being permitted to play into the same consumption patterns and the fossil fuel patterns that we were kind of holding them down. So that's one model. What else has come up in your conversations?
I think we were just talking, if I understand correctly, talking about just economic disparities in general and consumption patterns and haves and have-nots.
So that was the word that came up in that I was listening in on as well, thinking about just the capitalism, and you've got the, I don't know, the one percenters.
Mm-hmm. Or global 5%ers. That was
everyone else. And I mean the dross, I don't know. What is the dross of capitalism here? I mean,
you can put 1% to about 6%, I think.
6%?
Yeah.
Okay.
1 to 6. In other words, it's, you know,
yeah.
Let's make that pie a little bigger.
Yeah.
Let's let it trickle down a little.
All right.
I saw some of it in relation to racism.
Yeah, that was another theme that came up. And in fact, this fable is the prologue to a book called Understanding and Dismantling Racism.
Right.
And it's kind of a model for what it looks like. And so, of course, you've got the happiness machine, which I guess these days we would call probably white privilege. Well, no, let's not even call it white privilege. Let's call it racist institutions.
And lifestyle.
Let's change that again. Institutionalized racism.
And culture, I would say, too, in America. When you say that culture goes hand in hand with that.
Yeah. Okay.
We're happy to play along.
And then Ross, obviously, has to do with, I guess, the suppression of people of color. I don't know how you would put that, but...
all the impacts.
Yeah.
When the unhappy people said they didn't like it, they were killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about police brutality, you know, you think about that.
Right. Yeah, we could make a long list of the dross that goes along with racism. Other ideas? Yeah.
The dross on capitalism is really almost a reverse, where the dross is the money that is spent on the privileged,
mm-hmm.
and not on where the privileged suck all of the money up to serving themselves. Schools, for example.
So we could put something like inequitable distribution of wealth.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And spending.
And of course, that could also be very much dross down here in the racism category as well. Other things that popped up, these are all sort of high level. Big things. Did anybody think of this being a little bit smaller? Yeah.
Well, I was just struck by, I mean, after our initial discussion about saying how happiness can be this, that, or the other thing, this seemed to, in my opinion, very strongly focused on kind of material, seemed to be material aspects of wealth, or especially if dross is a substance, rather than, you know, that, and, or that's a zero-sum game, that there's a finite amount of quote-unquote happiness, and that some people have it. The more that some people have, the less that other people have, which is a very specific way of defining happiness. That we have
there's a conservation of happiness mass,
right.
And we distribute it around amongst the people.
Right.
And the more people on the planet, the less happiness for everyone.
Right.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, you're making me think about all these symptoms we're having in our culture right now.
Mm-hmm.
Suicide, drug abuse, self-medication, and I guess, I don't know where that fits in. I guess it's capitalism in that...
Well, it doesn't have to fit in.
It's
can be its own separate thing. That was what I was sort of trying to push you for here.
Okay, then, I don't know. I don't know how to say it.
What?
Mental health. Okay, all the privileged people are getting counseling to figure out why we're unhappy. And all the people who don't have resources, who have suffered through bad nutrition and lack of resources, and they are all self-medicating themselves. I mean, that's a gross generalization, but I mean, Is that some kind of an equation?
Well, I mean, to me, you know, I was asking this group here what they think that happiness machine looks like, and to me, it really gets at the idea of self-medication. It's so easy for me to imagine substance abuse as the happiness machine, and so then that starts to bring this down to a much smaller level, and you think about, well, what is the dross of addiction? When you've got a family member who's addicted to something, there's dross there. And there are unhappy people associated with it. And the unhappy people cannot just make their unhappiness go away by taking the same substance, for example. I mean, they could be permitted. And so it's a little bit of a twist on this, whether you're permitted or not permitted to it too. But to me, that's where this fable starts to get even more powerful, is when you get it to that level of addiction.
Except I would push back and say somebody who's taking drugs is only happy for about, you know, 1 month.
But they are pursuing
it. Do you think that these people are truly happy? That's one of the ironies of the happiness machine to my mind, is that they're not happy at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's research that shows that once you've met basic need structure, more wealth beyond that does not increase happiness. Mm-hmm. Although people become addicted to continue to accumulate.
I mean, Scott, to your point, there was, right before we left for Holden, there was that expose or whatever about almost a literal happiness machine, the people that made with however many opioid pills, on the ferry over here, they were talking about how many came to this county, and it's like enough for like every person in the county for a year to take one, and like it's a literal happiness machine, and it just completely wrecked lives.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, so this is getting to be a little bit more of a stretch, but you know, then I also start thinking about mental health.
Yeah.
And the way mental health creates its own dross and really starts to set up, and ultimately what this is all about is power structures, unbalanced, harmful power structures. And so you get into the mental health arena and you can start to imagine how you know, you get an unbalanced power structure with a lot of dross that starts to impact people around it. To me, mental health issues are basically emotional cancer. They have that same way of infesting everything around and metastasizing to family units, to friend units, to everyone around them. So, I mean, that's, you know, but I start to think about just power structures in general, these sort of unbalanced power structures, and, you know, mental health just can dominate a family unit. And you know, you're walking on eggshells, and the person with the mental health issues, I mean, there's, again, the happiness is not really there, and just like the happiness is not really here either, but everything sort of revolves around them.
And it's really hard because of the dismantling of the healthcare, mental health system in the country, in gross generalization again. It's very hard if you start having troubles to get to find somebody, you know. Mm-hmm. Good luck. You get on a list. Oh, maybe in 6 months, you know, we'll call you in 6 months. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah.
I just wonder where fear fits into all of this as well, because I feel like a lot of pursuit of happiness is actually not so much that there's this undercurrent of fear that motivates people to consume, to ravage, you know, their through resources, even mental health and addiction. There's just this undercurrent of fear.
Mm-hmm. Fear of kind of scarcity, or
can I add loneliness to it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I certainly think there's an
fear of failure.
There's an epidemic of loneliness as well right now, and I think that drives a lot of what we do as well.
Fear of failure.
Fear of failure, the white man disease here in this country, fear of failure.
It's almost like our survival, you know, the evolution of survival on steroids somehow.
Yeah. No, I mean the suicide rate for white men in America is as high as for Native Americans, maybe even higher. It's sort of an epidemic in this country, and a lot of that goes to that fear of failure. And failure is not an option if you're a white man in this country.
And
it just isn't.
And they're talking about the increase in youth right now,
yeah.
Young adults.
Mm-hmm. On your structural issues, big pharma really is a big part of the problem, creating the whole opioid epidemic.
That's the epidemic.
And Purdue Pharmacy was investigated by the Kefauver Commission 70 years ago for doing what they're still doing.
Wow.
And they made their billions on opioids and now have gotten patent rights for the drug that you have to take the rest of your life if you were addicted to opioids. So they're making money on the rebound.
Both coming and going.
Sure, and there isn't any legitimate control from the federal level because they're in bed with one another. And then the psychiatric establishment creates a manual of disorders, which is now written by the drug industry.
Yes.
So, you know, the big pharma is a huge part of a lot of these problems.
It's interesting to see them starting to take them to court. It's kind of interesting to watch that.
So since we've gotten into this class, I'm no longer happy.
But you were.
I was.
You need to bottle that and sell
so,
it.
So what can we do?
Well, I don't think
to make ourselves feel good.
Yeah,
about
I don't know that we're ready to deal with that. I mean, we cannot clean up our own dross. The happiness machine
like the dross be composted somehow.
You mentioned the story early on that Americans are addicted to hope.
Yeah.
We could say Americans are addicted to happiness, and he would argue perhaps we weren't put here to be happy. Perhaps we were here for a greater purpose than personal happiness.
Yeah, that's definitely that the individualistic aspect of it versus serving others and being part of community. There's certainly a part of that as well. So where I want to go with this here and now is just thinking about where we fit into the happiness machines around of, you know, and which ones we participate in. And thinking about, you know, every one of us is in multiple happy machines simultaneously from big scale down to personal relationship, individual scales here. And it says a lot about how we think and how we act and what motivates us to vote and how we vote. And the idea that, you know, thinking about the anatomy of peace, this heart of peace, heart of war idea where we see other people as objects or we see other people as human beings. And one of the ways to see other people as human beings is to understand where they fit into the different power structures and what their struggles are. Because I think most people will have at least one power structure where they're at the bottom. I mean, there may be some people who are gift-blessed enough that they're at the top of every power structure that exists, but a lot of us are at the bottom of a power structure, and that really represents what our struggles are, and that's really the place where we can start to relate to other human beings, where we can relate to each other in our struggles, I think in a more empathetic way that will move us to action to help each other based on what those struggles are. And so, I want to think a little bit more about that. And so what I was thinking is that we could spend some time diagnosing me.
Okay. Generous of you.
We need more time.
At least a bigger whiteboard.
Yeah, you know. I mean, you know a little bit about me by now, but you don't know everything about me. And I think that that's one of the things here is that that just by the nature of seeing me and what little you know, you already have some perceptions about who I am, what I do, where I might fit into thing. And you know, we're very good at stereotyping each other and making generalizations about each other. You know, you see somebody and you instantly have ideas about what power structures they fit in and whether they're privileged or not. So what power structures do you think would you put me in and put me at the top or the bottom of these different power structures?
Academia.
So academics, what kind of power structures? Am I in and am I on the top or am I on the bottom?
You're teaching a class.
You've got a PhD.
So in a classroom setting.
You're on top.
I'm on top.
You're in the University of California system, which is big and has prestige nationally, internationally.
You have some rank in your professorship.
Okay.
You have the ability to influence the next generation.
So that's sort of like, as a teacher.
Influential, yeah.
I suspect you are.
Feeling good? How about
where's
research?
Your case? I am a big power.
How about research monies?
What's that?
How about research and money? Bringing money into the school. Bringing students into the school.
Or just
grad school.
Sure.
Graduate
students. You know, I gripe and complain about it, but when push comes to shove, I have research money and I have students, and so I will say that I'm on top on there, but it's tough. It's very competitive getting research money. What else?
So the downside of, sorry, go ahead.
Would you say within UC Davis, as an institution, you're on top?
So let's say reputation.
Okay, if he's on top of everything.
On top relative to, I guess we're going to put world. Within UC Davis,
I would guess you're
bottom.
Small peanuts.
Yeah. Thank you. See, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're getting where we need to be here. I'm not just on top of the world here. Now you can relate to my struggles a little bit.
Let's go to another topic. We mind this one.
Yeah. You mentioned being a father of three adopted children from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Daughters? All three daughters?
Son and two daughters.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know what that category falls into, but you referenced some things that were difficult.
Right. So I'm going to put, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to do, behavioral challenges, family. I'm going to put it like that.
I'm guessing that's
more generic.
So it's not academics now, I'm guessing.
That is not.
In the middle, or are you in the bottom?
No.
Okay.
I'm definitely in the bottom.
Okay. You're a white male.
Yes, I am. I'm going to do white.
And you're on top, yeah.
And I'm going to do male.
You have to rub it in, don't you?
There's a caveat to this. Is this flipped upside down in a university setting, an academic setting, because diversity is highly, highly desired. And so, yeah, when I was doing job searches, for example, I got passed over on two different jobs because of the diversity issue. And which, you know, I mean, I understood it, and I can't complain because I ended up at UC Davis, and the places where I was passed over were in places that I would rather not have been in the long run. But you know, but it's not just that; it's also in terms of salary at UC Davis, in terms of research grant competitiveness, in terms of many different metrics within the academic setting. Here, I'm actually flipped, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. What else?
You're on the Holden board.
I am on the Holden board, yeah.
So that puts you
prestige
on top.
I think you're different, probably have a different motivation system than a lot of academics. You kind of come from a long line of clergymen in the generation ahead of you, so you've got more of a spiritual purpose.
So how would you put that up here in terms of like a power structure here?
I mean, is religion something that has...
I'll just throw this out there. I mean, it may mean that to you, as a servant leader, being on the bottom, you don't have to be on top or bottom to be a leader.
Oh, like serving God? Who's your... Serving God, serving the university, serving... I guess I'm not being very articulate about that, but...
Is there a cost to that?
A cost to...
Being a servant leader?
Yeah, there is a cost to it in terms of I am not willing to take on 12 graduate students at a time because I cannot give the proper attention that they need, that they deserve. And so I'm unwilling. I have colleagues who are more than happy to just load up with as many graduate students as they can, and I see how long it takes their students to get through and how much they suffer in the process, and I'm not willing to do that. I don't know where that puts me in the whole list of this stuff here, but...
It's kind of a moral, yeah. A moral category of some kind.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to put up another one here, too, sort of like, you know, economics.
I was going to say, are you a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of citizenship.
That's a good one. From traveling, that U.S. passport has a lot of power.
I would guess, as an academic, you're not in the top 1%.
I'm not in the top 1%.
Mm-hmm. Income?
Yeah. Yeah, the economics one is kind of a challenging one for me to think about, too, because, you know, when we were growing up, we were dirt poor. We just were. But, you know, there was no internet, so there was nothing to compare to. Everybody else in our town was about the same, and so it just didn't really matter until they struck oil, and then the farmers all got rich around us, and then they had the pool tables and the foosball tables, mm-hmm. my friends did, and so then that sort of created a little bit of envy on my part, but for the most part, I didn't think about it all that much when I was growing up. I was well into my 40s before we hit sort of break even. Mm-hmm. Money in, money equaling money out, and so, you know, it's only been in like the last 5 years or so that the concept of having disposable income that doesn't need to be earmarked for something has been there. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what to make of that at this point here. I mean, I've spent so much of my life being kind of on that bottom of that economic structure there that even if I'm no longer there, my mentality still is there. I mean, you know, you get that stuff ingrained in you very, very early. So I would say that maybe I'm on top-ish, sort of.
Is it okay to be in the middle? Can we have a middle?
We could probably have a middle too, yeah. All right, so I'll put myself.
Are you on top of the bottom?
No, I mean, that's an interesting, fascinating question, too, just asking people, you know, what they think the middle class is and how it's defined. Oh, yeah. For some people, the middle class starts at, like, 500,000,
right?
And, you know, and goes down from there. And I'm just thinking, you know, you live in a different world than I do.
Middle class becomes the middle 90%.
Yeah. Are you a homeowner?
I'm a homeowner.
And do you have health insurance?
Okay. I think I own over half my home now. Health insurance.
Politics. Are you just a voter? Do you have any other political influence?
Politics. Well, you know, I'm definitely feeling bottom right now. which is another interesting aspect here, too, as an environmental scientist. In an anti-science environment.
You also have your university in a broader hierarchy of...
I'm feeling
compared
bottom.
To other universities.
Within my department, I would say that I'm bottom-ish, for example, yeah.
But, I mean, where does Harvard fit?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, UC Davis is probably number one in many different environmental research categories within the U.S. And so from that perspective, in my field, UC Davis is about as good as I can get. I could, you know, coming from Stanford, coming from Harvard, maybe there would be a little bit more cachet, but I'm pretty set where I am. So at this point, what I would like to do is to take a break. I'd like for you to just think about the different power structures that you participate in from sort of an individual level all the way on up. And that's what I would like you to do. And then when we get back, we'll work with that a bit.
Individually or in our small group?
You mean when we get back?
Yeah.
We'll do small groups again, yeah.
Sure. You chose this over a nap, I'm impressed.
Well, I thought I've never been
to session
right
before.
Yeah.
I only know
power structures.
For those who felt
it's a different thing, kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I've been thinking about the same kind of thing, too. Just I've only known you as a young niece. And you're an adult
that
now.
I turned down.
So it's sort of been interesting interacting with you frankly, our conversation felt at a lot of times kind of just small talk. But you're an adult now, so why should everything that adults talk about be on the table, and why can't we talk about all of this?
So thoughtful.
So I find it funny when I talk to somebody that I know from a personal setting in the professional setting. Usually their voice changes, like the whole cadence of how, I don't know if that's true for him, for you, but or if he speaks naturally as he teaches. But everyone that I know personally, I call them at work, mm-hmm. just the way they answer their phones, like they don't sound like the same person.
Yeah.
I think I do a little bit, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm conscious of that kind of stuff, so I try not to do that.
You try not to be too affected as a presenter, yeah.
I don't know how successful I am, but I'm at least aware of that, and that's something that happens.
My wife is really funny like that. She's in a position where she gives a lot of presentations. She also sometimes preaches at our church, mm-hmm. and when she's in those presentation environments, like her whole mannerism and everything is totally different.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the God voice in church. What people's various God voices are.
Yeah.
You're my sister, Chris's mom, has a different kind of speaking voice when she preaches compared to when you're talking to her. Just on a personal level.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've ever pestered her on that or not.
Yeah. I don't think I have either.
But it's weird.
It is, and it's like hard to kind of explain in words the difference. But it is just different.
Yeah.
Just like even like the cadence she uses and the facial expression.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but Melinda, same thing with Melinda. Her preaching style of voice is different from talking one-on-one with her.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems to be a pretty common thing, actually. So, Sarah, how do you know Joe Barnt? What's the connection there?
Well, Joe used to be in Chicago.
Yeah, I knew about that just from the reading about that book and the history that he has.
Yeah, and he was involved in a lot of our lives, just in my brother and my sister-in-law and my husband and me, and he was right. And he was always involved with racial issues because we were all involved in those sort of things.
Is he still alive?
I actually don't know. And Joe was up here several years ago.
He was? Wow.
He was. He was on teaching staff. And I haven't seen him since then. I mean, we were very close for quite a long time, but...
Because I like his stuff, and it just frustrates
so it's
me. It frustrates me looking at some of the things that are out there right now in the literature. Like, I mean, you know, I've read Joseph Barnes' book, the Understanding Dismantling Racism, and I like the depth and the detail that he goes into it, kind of the systematic way that he has to break the whole thing down. And then our church decided to read the book Waking Up White. I read like 30 pages and I just had to, I couldn't stand it. It was just so horrible compared to the depth and complexity that it was being presented with in Joseph's book. And I don't know. So I like it. I like the way that he thinks about it. I like the way that he puts it together. And I would dearly love, I mean, the fact that he's been up to Holden, I would dearly love to somehow get him connected back here with the kind of work that we need to do.
He was always marched to his own tune in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, he never kind of, and he's Lutheran.
Yeah. So, and, I mean, would you be willing?
Well, what I mean is, I mean, we all love Joe.
Yeah.
You know, that was, but he didn't settle down, we'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. At least when we knew him, or I knew him, you know, but that was back quite in the 60s and 70s, you know, and things like that. So I actually don't know, I think he went to Milwaukee or something from there, but I don't think he could have a church. I mean, he wouldn't be that... No.
They'd be too settled down.
He would be too settled down.
No, but I guess what I'm asking about is would there be room for him being involved in just working with Holden?
Oh, he would. He would work. He worked with groups, mm-hmm. and unchallenged. Oh yeah.
And is he somebody that you would be willing to track down and solicit, or what would be the proper way to try to get him involved here?
Well, find out if he's alive.
That'd be a good one.
Well, if he was on teaching staff, wouldn't the...
Oh, gosh, that would have been back in...
Coordinator...
Oh, gosh, this is way back.
Oh, okay.
It's probably in the 80s. No, I don't know. I don't know when he was here. And we were here when he was here.
80s, you said he was here?
Well, I'm just kind of getting a decade. I don't know. Because we weren't here a lot in the 80s, but we were here when he was here.
But I mean, yeah, so just, you know, that book, there's a bit of a roadmap in there for what we
need to do. And I haven't looked at that book in ages. I may still have it.
Well, ages, I don't think it's that old.
Jeff Bond classes.
2010-ish.
He wrote that in 2010?
I don't know if that's
another one much earlier.
Classes.
Let me look. Yeah.
I can figure out. I can get the dates.
Okay. Yeah. It seems to me that's an update.
But it's nice to be told. Yeah. This
but I, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, speaking of Happiness Machine, surprised nobody said anything about social media.
Yeah.
No, yeah,
that's a good one.
I used to try to keep up with social media, and then one night a friend of mine on social media said, Twitter is the tool I use to make myself angry at strangers before I go to bed. And I said, actually, that's exactly what it's doing to me, and I haven't used it since then. That was sort of horrifying to realize.
2007.
It was 2007? What are his other books?
I don't know. The other ones, this is just, I have some excerpts from it, so that,
okay.
That's what I have, from 2007. So it's like,
what's the title of the book that you...
Understanding and Dismantling Racism, the 21st Century Challenge to White America.
Oh, well, he's updated, because he did do one earlier than that.
Yeah.
So, because he really was on racism, I mean, that was his focus, mm-hmm. and white racism in a lot of ways, too, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so in the book there's almost kind of a roadmap for what it looks like to try to get to an anti-racist state. And so the point of the book, I mean, so there's six stages in the path between full-on white supremacist racist institution to an anti-racist institution and multiculturalism, which is where most places are that care. Is stage three. So a lot of people think that they're done by diversifying the number, the racial, the ethnicity of the people that are involved in their system. But in fact, according to Joseph Barnt, there's three more steps that you got to get through before you're actually truly and fully anti-racist. And so
what's the name of the book?
Understanding and Dismantling Racism.
In the something about the
20th. Oh yeah, it was. I think you can get it with just the first part.
Understanding and Dismantling.
Yeah, Understanding and Dismantling Racism.
Okay. 2007.
The 21st Century Challenge to White America.
Peter, what is the, somebody mentioned Holden Board. Mm-hmm. How is that a it's a leadership position.
Yeah.
And you have some control, but is it really in this in the community? Is it seen as that? You know, is that seen as a big power group? Or I guess I've never been in.
So I think for most people, maybe I should wait and talk later, but I'll just talk now. I think an important thing to think to realize about power structures is that they're not all bad. And so we willingly enter into power structures because of convenience. It's convenience to have leadership taking care of things so that we don't have to. And so that's not necessarily a harmful balance of power there. It's just, it's sort of a contract and it works. And so Holden Board, I think, would mostly fall into that category, but it's also not too hard to imagine perceptions, and that for some people the perception would be that as a Holden Board member I have a certain amount of power over them and they have to watch what they do around me. Or Sarah. Sarah's a Holden Board member as well.
Oh, okay.
And so I mean, I don't know that I've really had that kind of experience, but it's just something that we kind of think about. Chris is also on the board. He's not here at the moment, but he'll be back.
It just doesn't, you all don't seem to, you know, you don't walk around with a badge on or anything. It's,
we don't.
I think we all know now.
I mean, we were walking around with a badge on during the board week just because we wanted people to see who we are and be able to talk to us and have conversations, but not because we were using it to cut in line at the snack bar, or it could be convenient.
Finally, you get this opportunity. You still have to be in line.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, and the same thing about being in a classroom setting. You know, there's it's a contract of sorts. There are students who want to learn, and I have things to teach them. And yet, at the end of the day, I have a power. I have the power there, and I could abuse that if I wanted to abuse it. It's a little bit harder to imagine how a board member would abuse power here. But maybe not. I mean, but that's the thing, you know, that's being in a leadership position, there's perceptions that can go along with it that are tricky. So, you know, I was coaching soccer for 10 years when my son was going through the system, and I was on the board of directors for the local soccer organization. I was the regional coach administrator for 4 of those years, and I was a DCA for a couple 3 years before that, which meant that I was not in charge of all the coaches, but I was in charge of a division, and I would build teams for that division. And I'm a very good coach. I don't want to say that in a bragging way. I just want to say that I'm a very good coach. And so my teams would win all the time, but people were absolutely convinced that it was because I was getting rosters stacked because of my position of power. And you know, it wasn't the case, but that perception there is really hard to deal with. I mean, you know, and so as a board member, I don't know what perceptions could be, but there could be perceptions. There could be perceptions that I'm on teaching staff this week because of my power as a board member. They couldn't say no. So there's you know, and I think that you have to be kind of aware of those things no matter how benign the power structure seems to be. But I mean, it is a fair point here that many power structures are beneficial, mutually beneficial, and whether you're on the top or the bottom, it's not harmful. It's something that you willingly enter into.
Yeah, and we look for leaders. You know, I think that's one thing that, you know, is the happy people and happy people. And there's little groups, but it's interesting to me. I would be interested to know who are those leaders, what kind of, how do they encourage people to follow them, and I just think leadership is a really crucial thing that we're looking for.
It is, and I think one of the unfortunate aspects of this country is that leadership is sort of equated to charisma and extroversion. And that's a dangerous thing too. And I think that we don't have enough space in our society for introverted leadership. I think we're missing out greatly by not tapping into introverted leadership.
And leadership, how do they get people to follow them? In another sense, how does leadership learn how to follow the people that are working beneath them, you know, top-down leadership versus leadership that leads from
the grassroots.
From the grassroots.
Yeah. All right, so it seems like we have people here who are going to be here.
It's okay, you can eat that in front of us.
You're not a threat.
Just ask me. I want you to know I came in here with an ice cream cone on, and I'm not thoughtless. I want you to know that when I went to get that cone, I was offered the whole 5-gallon bucket, and I thought, I just really can't come in and sit and eat ice cream out of it.
That would put you on top.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you brought 12 spoons with you, maybe that would have worked.
I'm not that generous.
All right, so when you look at my profile up here, and you know, it would be really easy to consider that I've got a lot of stuff going on. I've got it made. I have nothing to worry about. You know, you can come after me. My sister, well, no, I'm not going to pick on my sister. I won't do that. No, but it would be really easy to come after me and say, you have an extreme life privilege. You need to give something up so that I can have something.
But that's sort of
one-dimensional. But if you ask me what my life is like on a day-to-day basis and what my life has been like for the last 10 to 15 years, this dominates everything else.
Yeah.
And it's not even close. So if you come after me and just say, well, you know, you're on top, and you're on top of economics, and you're white, and you're male, and things like that, and you're screaming at me to give up stuff for you, how do you think I'm going to respond to that?
Defensively.
Yeah, defensively, because there's many, many days where my life is not good, because I have this power structure at which I'm on the bottom and which I'm struggling. And so I think that, to me, defines so much of what happened in the 2016 election, mm-hmm. where you have many, many white America lower class who've been trashed by the economy in terms of economics. They're at the bottom, and they're getting trashed out. And then you have other people coming at them and saying, you've got white privilege. You need to give up more. How are you going to react? You're going to react very, very defensively. And so the failure, to my mind, is the fact that, you know, in terms of racism, yes, racism is an important issue, but you have to acknowledge the struggles that everybody is going through on their own turf. I think everybody has got some kind of struggle that they're going through, and until you can sort of make that connection to what their struggle is and be willing to kind of work with them, if they'll work with you on building a better mental health system, then you're willing to work with them on trying to get to racial equity, economic equity, gender equity, whatever kind of equities that you have. I think that, you know, that's sort of an area, I think, where we need to find common ground in order to be able to build those connections and be able to lift everybody up together. Yeah.
I think, too, that it's in some of the other courses we've talked about, technology and communication, mm-hmm. I think that has also created, you know, the Facebook and so on, where even if I'm relatively stable, I see someone over there who has this, and I see another person who has that, and I see another person who has that, and I don't realize that that's all they have, but I don't understand why I don't have all of those things. So even if I'm not struggling, I perceive that everybody else is growing faster than I am.
Keeping up with the Joneses, yeah, the relativistic perspective on the world, yeah.
When you can see the best day of every Jones, mm-hmm. every
right,
day.
Right. Or the one best thing that
that every single Jones has.
That's right.
And we don't equate within our own mind why I don't have all of those things.
Right. I had a pretty good day last year. Right?
Yeah.
but it's not just things. It's a trip or an experience or a promotion or a whatever. We see all of that.
Yeah.
Maybe we should start posting about our challenges. Yeah. Change the paradigm.
But I think you're right. You know, anybody who's feeling trampled.
Yeah, trampled is a good word for it too. So what I would like to do here is to break up into small groups again. And I would like to invite you to share your the different power structures that you are involved in that are important to your life. I would like to this is something that we did last week, called mutual invitation. I would like to use that model for how we do this, so it's not sort of like, you know, just as a way of trying to kind of equalize the conversation here and just have an opportunity to think, to listen to what people are saying and not feel like you're obligated to respond to them. So not having a conversation, but just an opportunity here just to express what's on your mind and these things. And so the way that mutual invitation works, and you know, Chris, you've gone through that, and Sarah, you've gone through that. Anybody else here who's done mutual invitation? So maybe I'll split the three of you and allow you to just kind of lead the way this goes. But the idea is that the leader will start and say respond to this idea about which power structures, you know, maybe two or three that are most critical, the ones that sort of dominate your life, and if you're willing to share which one you think is the biggest struggle that motivates you to act, motivates you, dominates your life, that would be something that would be good. And then when you're done speaking, the idea is for you to invite someone else to speak. And they can choose to speak if they would like. They can choose to pass if they don't want to talk about themselves at all. That's okay. Or you can say pass for now, and then we'll cycle back around to you if you're not ready to talk about things. If the person who... Right, so then at the end of it, after you've invited the second person, when they're done talking, then it's up to them to invite the next person that they want to talk. So again, the idea is just to listen. And so so we did this as an exercise with the board and the staff, I guess it was last week, and it was really, really fascinating to, you know, I'm so used to interacting with people and they say something and I'm trying to figure out how to chime in and take that and move it all together. And I'm not listening to them as much as I need to be listening to them. And so that's kind of the idea behind mutual invitation here, is that you're just listening. And everybody gets a chance to have the floor. Everybody gets a chance to say, yes, I will respond. No, I won't respond. And you get the chance to invite someone else. So that's the basic concept of mutual invitation. I hadn't heard of it before, but I really liked it. And I think that there are certain places where I think that it has utility. And I think this might be one of them. And so I would like to give it a shot, and then we can actually talk about that and what that experience was like for you as well, if you're willing to do that. So if we can get Signe and Sarah and Chris into different groups, and I guess you can sort of cluster. I'm not going to number you all off. we'll just make sure that each one of you is in a different group. Have you done this before, Krista? Have you been part of the mutual invitation? Yeah. It is a sort of a Holden-ish thing.
It is a like a Holden-ish
thing. It is. Yeah.
We do it on our church council.
Yeah. And so each group should have either four or five people in it.
We need a couple more.
Yeah.
Sticker,
yeah,
just making sure.
Yeah. So if we could get one person from this group over in this group, that would be really good as well. I mean, Sarah, you have to be there, so.
I figured you probably did, but just a second.
Yeah.
Well, I am Sarah. You are Joe.
I'm Chris.
I'm Joe.
Yeah.
Joe.
I'm Scott.
Nancy, so I would like to present you that story. Chris.
John?
John.
You can tell us you're the best.
You are, Pam.
They're very angry about this.
I let it move
on to more addiction services, very challenging. And patients really feel they have a right.
Puts me in a good place in
power struggle that occupies
a lot of bodies right now. I'm not.
And no easy answers. Because there's no good research out there to support what
I am a citizen of this country, and
there's no good research that supports long-term opioids.
I do have health insurance.
There's just not enough research out there. So the medical community is split as well.
I am an older adult,
our way through
and that is a challenge.
And that's very challenging. One that I'm dealing with is part of me thinks I should continue to work so that I can give more alcohol. Because I am able to work, why not work so that I can give more than one heart away? So I'm caught in that power structure as well.
That plays into my life. I'm incredibly active in my community
And it feels good. It feels like a
little so time. I'm right.
Because even your end of day, you also have a good weight.
Can you turn audience sort of like this one?
The rat trap.
The same. There's nothing that you can do about the policy that you're pushing.
I'm invited to play a certain job.
We retire as
middle-class white people are experiencing that just 4 years.
And
that's most people around the world, most people.
I still think initially
and that was,
volunteer with
that was really the
pharmacy association. Several years.
Power
is another kind of power. Which I think to a certain extent, you know, we all see as we look at media on a federal level, but I'm fortunate in that I represent state office on the Health and Human Services Committee, so you know, I think that gives me a little bit of insight. But I see how much
tells all about
that happens, that gets heard and advances through the legislature.
Just being treated differently, especially getting comments.
To some extent, the members of the committee, the question whether to a significant extent, the chair of the committee, who is
sort of like, well, they're
a member of the majority party of that House.
And one of the biggest
so the committee chair in this relative area underneath that committee.
Everybody's sitting around talking.
They don't want to hear Bill.
Another
just our status as white people.
Get heard.
Madagascar.
Sort of like the
micro-inflation.
Then to some extent.
And we definitely.
Even if that committee chair wants to hear Bill. But leadership.
Our white is represented. Power.
It doesn't get hurt.
No, I'm sort of received.
So the idea of the role of just.
So that was something I needed to wrestle with.
Working within the system, I am frustrated with the futility of asking you to contact your legislator, to write your legislator, visit with your
legislator. The happiness machine and all that stuff.
I know that
I recently
interviewed
my
mother.
With whether that film
advances
past. If your legislator is not within every way the power structure,
because I was in debt,
and you know, a little bit younger.
So that's the power within a few people.
I feel like it underestimated.
In Minnesota,
640.
My abilities.
Was the only state in the union that has divided government with a Democratic governor and a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. I believe every other state in the union, all three are one party or the other. So, then you have two blockades or something that go through one house. It's not going anywhere.
That could lead to the power structure. So, me and my family being at the top of the church.
Whatever it is I believe in.
Yeah.
Take me out. Turn it back to you. Do you still want to?
I'll share now.
Well, certainly.
One thing I heard this time, we're in your retirement conference because we're planning that. And way back, on the 80s, I loved the bumper stickers. Live simply so others may simply live. I don't know. Honestly, the first year I saw it, I didn't know what that meant.
That gives me privileges.
So my dad, by 12, was orphaned and in the Depression.
That one I just
foreign national.
I feel like a little bit at the bottom because I'm
old. I love what you're saying. I've never thought of that. It's easy to be on time when you say that. That
it's easy to be
the longer you work, the
more kids
are off with their own family.
That's
an
old
world.
Another thing that I'm thinking about is what Paul
was
saying in one of his classes.
The city council.
I teeter between a Bible verse about
but I did live in Social Security. But I did
a
couple who had sold their property and me not to reveal how much they got.
Where I was working.
So he just kept them on the top.
This was our deal. And
courtesy of how we got to go to the University of Michigan.
The job of the board of priests and they said, you should have
watched my
day. 10% or whatever the time was at the time. I guess 10%.
14.
Education. The way he said that. Oh, no, no. That's all we paid for. And in the Bible, she goes, he drops it. Then the wife comes in and she says, no, it's that job is actually paid for it. So he drops it. And I jokingly said, he says, well, what do you think of that? I remember jokingly raised my hand and said, that sounds like a stewardship.
Raising my kids on campus.
And he laughed and he goes, we did it. We did it at my church. He said, they did kind of a pantomime thing. And
which.
They did that Bible verse and different people acted out and the congregation had Lou and his cards and but I thought so that what you said, work longer, give some away.
I don't know.
I really feel like retirement planning is really important. It's really that whole happiness machine
that kind of tells this kind of world that
it's a candy, right? You know.
So
let's buy a trailer, that's bad for the environment. So we're in this weird time where, I mean, retirement's a
fact.
There's a lot of aspects, and I just kind of thank you for
working. So I don't think financially we're very high on anything, but you know, as far as
these other things. Well, I think the mutual information, if someone else has something they want to add, say.
Here you all, how about the structure? You all covered a lot more later than I did, I feel like.
The power system.
Well, their brains have been hijacked. And they're like,
The whole pendulum when I first came into practice, the push was we are under treating pain, we have good drugs for pain, and on our patients are in pain and unnecessary
complaints.
A huge push within medicine to
Regulatory agencies.
Nursing homes, you go in and if you talk to a resident of the nursing home, have pain, yes. There's a citation for the nursing home, you have a resident with pain.
Jacob would cite hospitals.
I just where my mind goes when I hear that.
So the pendulum, we talk about the pendulum a lot.
My wife tells me I shouldn't weigh too heavily on it. I think I don't have to change every man's
mistakes.
Because you're in Washington.
That's right.
Well, and I'm not a native Texan, and I'm sort of a, I'm a reluctant Texan. I came to Texas to go to school.
Can we just go for like maybe a minute or two more here, and then we'll bring you back around?
So it's like they got me here, but I want to go here.
Let's bring everything back together here. I wanna.
And I can do that too. Yeah. But
you're not in a hurry.
So first of all, I guess I would just like to hear a little bit about what you think about the process of mutual invitation, and because again, it's nothing I had heard about until last week, and I think that it's got some utility. I think there are certain environments where it probably wouldn't work so well. So I'm just wondering how you felt about it, just right here, right now. Like it, dislike it.
Found myself invited to ramble, which I'm not sure was good.
Well, but did you feel heard? I guess that's the first question. Did everybody here feel heard?
Yes. It's really good for overshares and overtalkers like me. I talk too much in groups.
Yeah.
It's really, really good for me.
Really, really good, meaning that since other people get the floor,
it breaks me. Yeah, it puts a brake on me.
Okay.
It's really good.
And did it change? So the fact that you could just sort of respond to it, did you listen in a different way? Did you hear things in a different way because you were just sitting there listening and not having to respond?
Yes.
Yeah.
Last week at Augustana, we had a conference, and a Native American professor did this with Parkinson's, and it's the same basic idea. You don't say anything until you get it, and you're goal is to listen rather than to compete.
Oh, it's hard. I mean, I was just listening to the four of you talk, and it's like, if I could have jumped in constantly, and I could have responded to so much that was said there. I mean, but I didn't, because it was just really interesting also to see how, I mean, I think I could see it in your body language, just the fact that you were talking and the floor was yours and you weren't going to get interrupted and you got to say what you needed to say. And I thought that was really kind of, you know, because before I was participating and I wasn't observing it, and so it was really interesting from my perspective to observe and kind of look at it more from the outside.
I had to bite my tongue a couple of times because she's talking about working with opioid addiction, and I'm a pharmacist.
I know. So. Yeah. Yeah. And so, do you feel like the other people in your group are more human now? I mean, it's a vulnerable thing. Did any of you feel uncomfortable sharing, but did it anyway, or was it okay? So you felt a vulnerability to it? Do you still feel vulnerable? A little bit, or is it okay?
They were very supportive.
Yeah. So all in all, it felt like a pretty good process for the topic.
I wonder if it makes people feel vulnerable. Different people feel vulnerable based off of what they're sharing. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's on top on so many things,
yeah,
then they might not feel so vulnerable to share.
Yeah, there are degrees. I mean, I think we run into a lot of, it's a dangerous thing to compare your pain to someone else's pain and put it all on a relativistic scale. Because, I mean, I think it's a lot like like our sense of smell. You know, if you are exposed to a strong odor, your smell is measuring the gradient. So you see the change, you're overwhelmed with the smell, but then your sensory dies down and you don't smell it so much, or you don't smell it at all. And I think that's kind of the way that we look at pain a little bit too, and comparing the different levels of pain. I don't know that I don't know if that's how valid that is, how productive that is. Because I think we sort of get dulled a little bit to our own sense of pain. It just is what it is. And we have to cope with it however we have to cope with it. But I guess, you know, again, thinking about what happened in the election, but just thinking about the conflict that we have in the U.S., the polarization that we have in the U.S. right now, and I've really been working hard to figure out how I can start to have a conversation with other people. And if you can, if I'm willing to share where my struggles are and they're willing to share where their struggles are, I think that then you've sort of opened up a little bit, and I think that then you can start to find some of that common ground that allows you to build on.
I suggest asking questions. When I have conversations with my Minnesota relatives, I ask questions, and then they answer, and then I just respond with a couple sentences, and then we ask the next question, and it's just a more inviting and inquiry instead of I have an opinion about something.
So do you have a scripted list of questions? You just pull it out and start rattling down.
How are you feeling about the economy? Is a good way to start.
Yeah.
You know, how are you feeling about the border? You ask that and then you listen. You're letting them have the first word. You get the last word, but you know, it's more of a dialogue that way, and it's not about preaching.
Oh, and I'm going to challenge you on this.
Please.
Because my husband's sister does the same thing. And he says, I just can't take it anymore. She's completely interviewing me. Mm-hmm. As if I'm in a job interview all the time. You know, what is my position on this and this and this and this? She won't say hers. She won't come out but she will tell you you're wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's like, he says, and she goes up to people and she says, oh, what's your name and where are you from and list. And her husband says, oh, yes, she just interviews everyone.
I have a relative who does that, and it was sort of like a family, not a family joke, but just a family observation of that, oh, that's just what they do.
That's right.
And it's an interesting perspective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This would be more like a one-on-one with my favorite aunt. You know, oh, it's just a conversation, not an inquisition.
So there is an organization called Better Angels. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. It's pretty grassroots. It's maybe a couple years old, and their whole point is to take 10 people who are dyed-in-the-wool red staters and 10 people who are dyed-in-the-wool blue staters, put them together for a weekend, and have them enter into dialogue and into relationship. And the Better Angels title has nothing to do with religion or heaven. It has to do with the second inauguration address by Abraham Lincoln. And it was post-Civil War, and our better angels will be what gets us through this post-war kind of event. And I'm a vicarious guy. It costs $10 to join Better Angels. But then there's debates that they have. You can go to one of these weekends where there's folks together in the room, and their testimonies are such that I came in and I hated all 10 of those people over there, and they all hated me, but by the end of the weekend we're friends. Yeah. We don't agree on our positions, but we have entered into really, and it's so if you want a little drop of hope, go check out the website Better Angels. And you can be vicarious, or you can participate. There's all sorts of things you could do.
That sounds lovely.
Several Sundays ago in Sioux Falls, our pastor built into a sermon a new book called Dignity, Searching for Respect in Back Row America. I went right out after church and bought it. And what it is basically describing that this whole underclass that we're all frustrated with, what is really going on with them. And we're sitting here in front row America. Right. We wonderful, liberal, educated people. Looking down. And I said after I read it, whoever's running for president better read that book if you have any idea that we're gonna get out of this sort of thing. And I can't think of the name of the author, but Dignity, Searching for Respect in Back Row America. And Back Row America is that group.
Back Row?
Back Row.
Back Row.
See, we're in the
back
front row.
The front row, back row.
Yeah.
Searching for
Respect in Back Row. And if, I guess you can't Google to get the author, but it's Chris something that starts with A, but it's got a simple title, Dignity.
And yours was Better Angels.
BetterAngels.org. I'm pretty sure it's a .org.
Wonderful.
The guy that wrote this was a PhD stockbroker, mm-hmm, who got disillusioned and used his photography skills to go where all these people are and get their stories and just to listen to their stories. And it's pretty amazing.
Well, it seems to me that, well, in Chicago, that a lot of the stories that are in the media, I mean, has to do with the decline of the middle class. Mm-hmm. And with people losing their jobs, with salaries not going, going any up, with pensions going away or you're paying more or various things for health insurance, with the price of going to college, with debt that has to do with that. And so there's a real concern, at least in our city, across the board, in terms of how that's affecting neighborhoods, people being pushed out of neighborhoods because they're becoming too expensive to live in that one could used to live in. Mm-hmm. Very, working neighborhoods that are changing a great deal, and those people are being moved different places. Yeah. So,
and again, I mean, that really gets back to that idea that these people are not being heard. And if there's a lot of suffering out there, and if we're not hearing the people, they're not going to vote the way you think they're going to vote.
Yep.
They're just not. And so I mean, I don't have anything left on the agenda here, and so I'm happy to let people keep talking. I'm happy to have people go, and whatever you want to do is fine at this point. And if you have ideas for other ways that this could be presented, this could be worked, different way that I could do this, I would be also happy to hear that too, because this is kind of an experiment today for all of it. I mean, I have spent, you know, worked on this. If anybody would like to have a copy of The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, that was my you know, ace in the hole here if we ran out of things to say at a quarter till three. But we didn't.
And what is that?
The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. It's another short story. It's by Ursula Le Guin. If you read it, it's pretty obvious how it fits in with this thing. I mean, that was so when I teach this class, I start the first week with this fable. We work on that, and then we have The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, and we spend another one watching This Changes Everything, the film by Naomi Klein that really hits the climate change aspect of it that we talked about before. We read excerpts from The Jungle. I don't know how many of you are familiar with The Jungle. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chicago meatpacking yards. I mean, there's an economic power structure where they're just crushing those immigrants and, you know, extracting every last bit of capital out of them and then tossing them aside. And so one of the fascinating things about that book, I mean, we think that's in the past. But it's not. It's you know, we've just sort of exported that to third world countries. But then you think about the lower class right now, and they're still working for the man. They're still getting crushed economically. It's just at a little bit higher level, as subsidized by fossil fuels. And then we talk about it from the perspective of addiction. And so, you know, I've had this go through kind of the 12 step. Sort of a secularized version of the 12-step program, just to see how we think that might relate to getting ourselves out of an addictive power structure, which is kind of interesting to think about as well. So I don't know. There's a lot of different ways that I go with this topic over the course of a quarter, trying to look at it from different angles. Of course, we spend a couple of weeks talking about racism because that's fundamentally where this thing comes from too, and that's a really interesting debate too, not debate, discussion. But I think that in terms, you know, like this idea of mutual invitation here, I'm realizing that there's a lot of room for that in some of the different topics that come up in my class, and so I need to incorporate that a little bit more for it too. But.
Especially after you've met a couple of times, you know, in a small group, and you get, you know, it's like a layer.
Right, you start to learn.
You start peeling the apple, and then you get to the.
You start to learn who the talkers are. And then you can, you know, it's a way of trying to get things balanced out. Anybody want 4 pages? Anybody want The Ones Who Walk Away? Or, I mean, I can make some more, actually, if you want.
I would love to copy some more. Can we get it online?
Probably, maybe. If, you know, I could go up and just run off a few copies. Like, how many copies do you want?
I'll just go to that. I don't need a copy. I'll make a note.
Okay.
Tell me if you can find it.
All right.
Let me
just go up and
just enough to take a note.
I was gonna say you have
what's that
service?
No,
I could leave one in the library too, but I'll just go up and
just I'm using it as
five copies or so. Magic.
I'm glad I don't.
It doesn't.
No.
You do it back to back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
I'll do that.
No connection.
So I'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Thank you.
You can go if you want to do something.
Chris. I'm Scott, by the way. I know your name. You didn't know mine.
Sister.
That Better Angels is so important, and it's funny. Like, so I have a...
Well, familiar with them?
I'm not. Okay. And what you're describing.
Yeah,
and recently, so my 9 and 12-year-old, they grew up in Austin, Texas, which, as you know, is sort of a blue haven within Red, Texas.
And retired.
We were in line. We were in line for barbecue because that's what we do on that. And the guy behind us in line, I don't remember exactly what happened with my kids, but something bad happened, and he helped. He had no reason to help, and he did. And they were so grateful and thankful, and then they realized that he was wearing a Trump shirt.
There you go.
And afterwards, they're like, "I think the Trump shirt was nice." And I'm like,
because
yeah, that should happen.
And they'll do live audio tests.
Is she able to advocate for herself?
Once every 4 to 6 weeks. And the topic will be immigration. And they'll have a Republican and a Democrat. Citizens, not politicians.
No, of course.
That's the thing. And you can see from the other point of view that there's a real
them.
Because they may all fear something.
They may
but there's a fear there for some reason at all that you can't imagine.
And or they may be.
That's when you start lying through there. You don't think that. But there's rationale and upbringing and a life experience.
So going before them on her own.
Human as
a whole.
A physician who's cared for she has never gone
right now.
He says, how do you want me to describe
you?
She says, to say, I'm a prostitute, I'm a mother of six souls, and a child of God.
Need to keep
it just blows up your stereotype.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's pretty more complicated.
I'm not sure that he's really interested in
that's the dilemma. Is she has no way to differentiate herself from how do you convince them?
I can find this. It's not going to be a standalone thing. I stumbled onto reading short stories in my books, and it's such a great way because you're going to get 20 rosters in a couple of years.
I'm a child.
Maybe five of them are ones that catch interest. But that's five more hours long.
Well, they make
such a big
Missouri is the only state that does not have
one of those. Is that one thing?
And the states are
this one is?
Yeah, you can have that description.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your session.
And the key has been in Minnesota getting physicians more conscientious.
Well, sort of like older. I mean, you know, all the women you can have the one.
Prescribers.
don't have time.
What do you have?
I don't have time. Time in my day, probably.
200?
You can delegate.
More?
It was more. It was like
pharmacist can delegate technicians.
Sure. Yeah.
30 some thousand.
They don't even have to be a nurse. Can delegate to somebody in the office.
Person, yeah.
So-and-so's coming in. Would you write a profile? So that I have it when it has it.
From the 7 to Luther, I think there was about 444.
Yes.
Was that an adjustment?
Not.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Of course. Cumbersome process to do.
It looks good.
I've never
In retrospect, I wish that I had been at least in Minnesota.
It's been a number of years since I've worked.
Yeah. I was just growing up in a small town.
In Minnesota, I have no legal
intellectual ambition.
Legitimate.
That's not where you need to be.
Reason to go and pull a profile on somebody.
Yeah. Does your mom talk about that a little bit?
It would be illegal for me.
Yeah. Not that I can recall. Can we switch topics? Would you share some advice with us?
I mean, we didn't even talk about what my childhood was like in terms of power structures, but that's a pastor's kid in a small town.
Fresh.
A different set of rules than everybody else.
Any advice?
As a smart kid.
As far as pitfalls,
stereotyping
joys, hindsight.
The vast majority of the same people thing. Are very happy in retirement, are busy, although I visited with one individual.
The thing that saved me was that I was also good in basketball. And so at some point there, I was muscle and I accepted it. So yeah,
with my mom,
I'm
sorry, I can't help you.
I got her time period and then Marsha.
I can't identify because
he wanted to kind of bail us out, but
I think one is getting qualified for Medicare.
Who was it that you were interviewing to?
I'm Cheryl.
That's going to cost, $40,000.
Is this a relational thing?
Because we'll be 63.
She's my niece.
And so we're looking at that going,
I guess that's really important.
My sister is one reason.
Okay. The sister you're not going to talk about or you'll pick on.
Well, it's the other sister. So my younger sister is the first interracial adoption in North Dakota.
That's right.
And so, it's relevant, but it's her story. It's not my story.
Yeah.
So I try to stay away.
This is how you calculate how much money you need.
So I was going to, but I decided not to.
I didn't know that.
It's a fallacy. What do you want to do?
She was an outcast. My mom wrote a population bomb and decided that that
then
was
maybe you
better way to grow the family.
I want to stay home and work in my garden.
So this is part of the Pernis too?
Move to a small town and buy a house and a
She's got some Pernis blood in her.
I went to school with Sam Pernis.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was our pastor in Lenox. So we got double dose there. I've met all of the Pernis guys.
Mm-hmm. Is this the family in North Dakota?
Yeah. Well, there were seven brothers.
And they heavily went into the ministry in that generation above.
Was that
right? Yeah, four of them were pastors, one pilot,
for
one civil engineer.
You really need to know when you're going to die.
Uncle physics instructor at that college.
The thing is, it's...
Are you in school somewhere?
I graduated as a junior.
And now what are you doing at the moment?
What you're going to be doing in the next 7 months.
Half a dozen letters to the partnership at the University of Washington.
So that I can.
Mm-hmm. And said, I'm interested in this field. I want to go to graduate school someplace. I have no idea what I want to go to graduate school in. Do you have any technician jobs openings where I could just, see what your place is all about? And one of those letters was my oceanography. So my eventual PhD advisor's tech had just quit, so he was looking for replacements. He saw my letter and called one of my professors back at Luther and just hired me sight unseen. That was that.
It is. It's just like
so I left here and had a job.
Random events.
Yeah.
And you just can't get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so in that sense, I was lucky, but I mean, that was, but you're right, it's like,
to have us,
I needed to know what field I was going to do graduate school in, and I wasn't going to get that done here. But at the same time, I dearly wanted to be here for another year. And was, the reason I left is because student loans, the 6 month,
it's not that bad, it's just that,
you know, the six month deferral period or whatever, the no interest period was running out and I needed a way to wait.
You know, like you're just kind of weary of the job.
That's why I left.
You're looking for something new, but you're exactly right.
Amazing.
You know, what you make
here at the top of all those little events that sort of push you in different directions. In reality, it's all so random, but when you look at it, it looks like it was.
So you designed. Are kind of defined, but in terms of a life,
I mean, everything, you know, all the way up to getting my background really, position.
I just couldn't think of anything else.
Looks like it's
But that's just been on my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a big burden, but
it's a huge transition.
Didn't feel like it.
Yeah.
It just isn't, you know, we don't know what's going to happen the next day.
And you're from Chicago?
No, that's true. Yeah.
And what so did you do in Chicago?
Well, I worked in the Chicago Freedom Movement.
Yes.
Worked with a colleague at a place called Allendale, if you know where that is.
I don't know.
Anyway, that's a residential treatment center for
couples.
No, it's actually north of the city, Lakeville. And you taught somewhere, you said?
I did. I actually taught in a working kind of suburb, actually.
It was just great.
My first teaching career was in the middle of school.
You're not able to do that.
And then you said a youth agency you worked in?
Yeah, it was in Hyde Park. Blue Gardner.
Because I know he's been doing a lot of
I worked at the students
told me this
you know, like an after-school program. Head University of Chicago students. And then all of a sudden, the university decided, let's just kind of program, it's not that didn't necessarily take away our agency. Our agency was doing other things.